Good evening. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here at Global Patriot Radio, where we can be found every day on blogtalkradio.com. It is Wednesday, May the 10th, 2023. Yeah, we got a lot going on today. Every day, really, but especially today with that news conference or a news announcement this morning from James Comer. And lots of other stuff. Hey, to interact with our show anytime, come on during the show, listen in the chat room, just log in and go to live and look for Global Patriot Radio, or you can just listen online, www.blogtalkradio.com, and look for shows on politics or sports. Or, of course, you can call in anytime during the show, 319-527-6706. And we are here to talk, and you can also talk with us if you don't want to just listen. Hit the one on your phone. Every day we've got some kind of thing going on here. Mondays, Vito Esposito show with Vito and Big Al, 6 o'clock Eastern time. Tuesdays, Vito will take it, or Al, depending. And it's not always a show every day right now, sort of waiting to see what our next host will be doing. Wednesdays, of course, it's me, Hank Jones, 5:30 or 6 o'clock every Wednesday. Thursdays, it's Hankerings, my sort of follow-up show. I do that usually once a month, so a week from tomorrow I'll do a show, usually an hour, on something that I just cover a single topic. Fridays, Vito's in with Conservative Casual Friday. Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time, Minister Usama Dakduk and the Beautiful Christie revealing the truth about Islam. And then Sundays, 3 p.m. Eastern, Eric is in with Cross and Crescent Discussion, a.k.a. Real Interfaith Dialogue. And again, you can listen to our shows anytime in the archive. If you just come in and look for Global Patriot Radio, it'll take you to our list of episodes. Wow. Like I said, a lot going on. I am here in the official Space Force Observation Outpost of Hank Jones Polysports. Mini Aussie has been fed. My better half is working over at Acoustic Hankland, working hard, getting ready to go away for the weekend, her birthday coming up. Should be fun. Do a lot of paddling, actually. Today's first Internet Laffy is from Andrew C., 1776 on Twitter. It says, Kentucky Derby winner declines White House invitation. If I wanted to see a horse's ass, I would have come in second. God, no second Internet Laffy needed today with that one. Let's get to our obituaries. We got a full show with just what Mike and I are going to finish talking about, our part three tribute of great guitarists who are no longer here. We're talking about, of course, George Harrison and John Lennon, their solo work. Let us get to our obituaries. Last Wednesday, we lost former NBA player and executive, as well as broadcaster Lance Banks, committed suicide at age 56. His last 3 years were spent as an analyst for University of Texas on the Longhorn Network. Last Thursday, we lost Australian author Gabrielle Carey at age 64. No cause was listed. She was the co-author of a book in Australia called Puberty Blues. It was a book about the lives of Aussie surfers and their girlfriends, which she and Kathy Lett co-wrote while they were still teenagers. The book was made into a movie, which I endured back in college days on Cinemax. It's one of those Cinemax softcore deals. Later became a TV series. Never watched that. Saturday, we lost former American mountaineer and physician Tom Hornbein at age 92. He was one of several who reached the summit of Mount Everest on the same expedition in which Jim Whittaker became the first American to reach the top. We also lost former Oakland A's pitcher Vida Blue, complications of cancer, age 73. He was on the A's team that won five straight AL West titles, as well as three World Series championships, 72, 73, 74. Wow, I remember Vida Blue. Dude was larger than life there for a while. He had some drug issues, I know, in the league. Also some free agency issues. Sunday, we lost former PGA player Don January, age 93. He had won 10 PGA titles on the tour. He won 22 on the senior tour slash now known as the Champions Tour. His sole major was in the 67 PGA Championship. He won a playoff over Don Massengale. Monday, 2 days ago, we lost former Hall of Famer Joe Capp. He started in college at University of California Golden Bears. Then as a pro, he was with the BC Lions of the CFL and then the Vikings in the NFL. Good stuff with the Vikings. Took them to the Super Bowl. They lost to the Chiefs. I think that was Super Bowl III, but I'm not sure exactly. He still holds the record of 7 TD passes in a game. He also was in the movie The Longest Yard, where he played a prison guard who was also on that football team. Passed away from Alzheimer's. He was 85. And then yesterday, this was kind of a shock. Although we 86 years old, we lost former Louisville Cardinals head basketball coach Denny Crum, 86. He won 2 titles with the Cardinals in 1980 and 1986. He also reached the Final Four in 1972, 75, 82, and 83. Now, he coached that 1980 team where the Iowa Hawkeyes, they weren't winning big. I mean, revisionist historians like to think that we were winning huge. We actually weren't. We were winning, I think, by 3 or 4 points, and Roddy Lester went down, recurrence of his knee injury, and that effectively took us out of the rest of the NCAA tournament. The last Final Four the Hawkeyes went to on the men's side. Don't forget my friends at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center and messaging service for your medical clinic, hospital clinic, large service company, small service company, surveys, government agencies. They work with remote staff, so guess what? A natural disaster isn't a natural disaster everywhere. So remote staff can always be logged in. And if you like working remotely, give that a thought. And if you're in one of those offices where, hey, we've never gone back since COVID and we're never going back, you still need a front line to take calls and identify your company. Give Alliance a call, 800-555-3738, or look them up on the web, alliancecommunications.com. Quickies, I mentioned today Kentucky Congressman James Comer outlined some of the financial sleaze perpetrated by the Biden family in a news conference. It included the info at least 9 Biden family members reaped over $10 million from several foreign sources, including individuals, companies, and government officials. It goes back to at least 2009, when Dopey Joe was serving as VP under former President Barack Obama. Well, I'm not sure why they haven't looked into the Obamas as well. I would think this would be precedent for them to do so. I'm guessing there'll be more about this in the coming days. I got to believe there will be. So stay tuned for it. We'll cover it here, what we think's worth covering. But yeah, I'm not sure why none of this has surfaced about the Obamas. I cannot believe the Obamas' time. Just can't. Welcome Duck Northwest Media to the chat room as well. Over on the phones, Sue from New Mexico, my big sister, and Hawkeye Mike is listening in. He's going to be in later with our Beatles guitar tribute. So first item, looks like the government is going to run out of money by June 1st. Yeah, but don't let that stop the National Association of Government Employees, you know, the union that represents government employees, from suing our president and treasury secretary to not allow them to shut down the government. Seriously, you cannot make this stuff up. You just can't. You can't. But according to the media,
always true, it's damn true.
Yeah, it's true. They really are. So without further ado, here, before this once great and once wealthy country runs out of cash, here's Yahoo's version of the story. Just highlights here, but really hard to believe that our government union is suing our government to force it not to shut down. Government employees asked a federal judge to order Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen to continue borrowing. Talks to raise the national debt ceiling fail. the National Association of Government Employees, NAGE, the union represents 75,000 federal agency and military employees. They sued President Joe Biden and Secretary Yellen Monday in an attempt to avoid the kind of government shutdown experienced in 2019 when Democrat congressional leaders refused to fund President Trump's border wall. Biden and congressional Republicans are locked in a stare down over raising our $31.4 trillion borrowing limit. Republican leaders are demanding promises of future spending cuts. Biden has insisted on a clean increase with budget talks kept separate. Biden is scheduled to meet with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. That was supposed to meet yesterday. In the lawsuit, NAGE asked that the debt ceiling statute be declared unconstitutional as a violation of the separation of powers and obligation to pay America's debts. The union claims neither Biden nor Yellen is empowered and choose which bills to pay if the U.S. faces default by failing to borrow. That, they say, is Congress's job. Yeah, it is. That says, while not challenging here in principle the controversial proposition that Congress can limit the indebtedness of the United States, plaintiff asserts that Congress may not do so without at least setting the order and priority of payments once that limit is reached, instead of leaving it to the president to do so. Seeking a court order preventing any layoffs, furloughs, or reduction in benefits for federal workers. Ask that Yellen and Biden be barred from involving or relying upon the debt limit statute to defund any part of the operations of the federal government approved by Congress unless and until Congress specifically directs. Closes the article with, the U.S. Yellen has warned the U.S. may run out of cash as early as June 1st. Literally, only in a country where government is permeated with people who have no regard for it, that country's founding principles would we see this. How in hell can we be watching this kind of crap happen again? And how can a government employee, who, by the way, has never faced actual employment issues, look any citizen, hell, anybody, even illegal aliens, how can we look them in the eye? We're actually talking about people who had zero worries about losing their jobs through some of our worst modern crises, whether it's COVID, financial meltdowns, natural disasters, whatever. They can't even accept the prospect of a bankrupt government, which they, in large part, have helped. They've worked to perpetuate the things that bring about that bankrupt government. Good God, the collective IQ of this country, low as it is, could be increased by tens of points, hell, dozens of points. If we just bounced these folks to Exile Island and rebooted the whole hiring process, I swear to God. Well, let's put it this way. It's time for this again. It is time for this. We must play this.
So why don't we dive right in by interpreting one of the easiest events in the last 20 years of American history. Now, can someone tell me why in 1975 we pulled our troops out of Vietnam?
The failure of Vietnam invasion to win popular support caused an ongoing erosion of confidence in the various American but illegal Saigon regimes.
Is she right? Because I know that's the popular version of what went on there. I know a lot of people like to believe that. I wish I could, but I was there. I wasn't here in the classroom, hoping I was right, thinking about it. I was up on my knees in rice paddies with guns and Edward going up against Charlie, slugging it out with him, while pussies like you were back there partying, putting headbands on, doing drugs, listening to the goddamn Beatle album.
Hey, Professor, take it easy, will you? I mean, these kids, they were in grade school at the time. And me, I'm not a fighter. I'm a lover.
Well, I didn't know you wanted to get involved with the discussion, Mr. Helper. But since you want to help, maybe you can help me, okay? You remember that thing we had about 30 years ago called that Korean conflict? Yeah, where we failed to achieve victory. How come we didn't cross the 38th parallel and push those rice eaters back to the Great Wall of China and take the first brick and nuke them back into the fucking Stone Age River? How come? Tell me why. Say it. Say it.
All right. I'll say it. Because Truman was too much of a pussy wimp to let MacArthur go in there and blow out those commie bastards.
Good answer. Good answer. I like the way you think. I'm going to be watching you.
Good teacher. He really seems to care. About what, I have no idea.
Literally, folks, that's the best I could do at this point. I mean, I am literally speechless when I read or see or hear this combination of lunacy and delusion and arrogance. My God. Suing to keep a bankrupt government open. Speaking of lunacy and delusion, and maybe even arrogance, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky is stepping down effective at the end of June. Now, I realize that's about 2 years too late. But hey, you know, there could always be somebody worse. And there probably will be. So maybe we should just enjoy her while we can, I guess. Anyway, here's a bit of it from the Epoch Times with my usual interjection of cynicism. And, of course, immature sarcasm. The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is resigning. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is stepping down at the end of June, the director told President Biden in a letter that the CDC said happened on May 5th. Walensky, 54, did not cite a specific reason, and the CDC did not return requests for comment. She believes the CDC is in a better position now than when she assumed the post on January 20th, 2021, the same day Biden was inaugurated. She actually believes that. The end of the COVID-19 public health emergency marks a tremendous transition for our country, for public health, and in my tenure as CDC director. I took on this role at your request with the goal of leaving behind the dark days of the pandemic and moving CDC and public health forward into a much better and more trusted place. Walensky told Biden. In the process, we saved and improved lives, protected the country and the world from the greatest infectious disease threat we have seen in over 100 years. Are you kidding me? Public health has not only not moved forward, it is definitely not in a much better and more trusted place. Doc. We didn't save and improve lives or protect the country. And the world. Love that. And the world. During the first year of Walensky's tenure, the United States recorded more COVID-19 deaths than the previous year, despite the aggressive promotion of vaccines. Walensky has been a fierce advocate of vaccination, urging parents to vaccinate their children, and dismiss concerns about side effects like heart inflammation. She also urged people to get multiple boosters to try to combat waning effectiveness while downplaying natural immunity. Exactly. They literally pushed us, and with every strain and every surge, they've urged more boosters, which obviously weren't hurting or helping because people were still getting it. People were getting it multiple times. Before becoming the CDC director, Walensky was chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Mass General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Yeah, the same school, Harvard, where Dr. Charles Lieber was arrested and took a plea deal for failing to disclose their ties to the Chinese Communist Party and the Wuhan Institute of Technology. That distinguished Harvard. The position of CDC director does not require Senate confirmation, unlike similar positions, such as the head of the FDA. Biden administration officials have not identified potential replacements as of yet. Some officials praised Walensky, asserting she's done a good job. Biden said in a statement that Walensky, quote, has saved lives with her steadfast and unwavering focus on the health of every American. Why has our life expectancy gone down, Dole? And that, quote, we have all benefited from her service and dedication to public health, and I wish her the best in her next chapter. She took the reins of the Center for Disease Control during the most disruptive global pandemic in a century. And, of course, as the article pointed out earlier, was there for a larger death toll than the previous year. Goes on to say, I wish her well in her next role and hope her work to improve morale for the dedicated doctors, nurses, scientists, and other public health experts at CDC and to strengthen the public health in the United States and around the world continues with the next director. Others say she failed. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, she's a failed CDC leader. I've never seen trust in American public health lower. Nailed it. Absolutely nailed it. It's literally never been lower. I have doctor friends. I've been on paddles with doctors who they have to sort of be careful, but they basically say the same thing. She's a failed leader. The government failed. Caria answered, went on, whoever takes over is going to have to, will have a lot of work to do to restore trust in public health and the reputation of the CDC. Walensky and other officials made multiple false statements on COVID-19, including exaggerating the effectiveness of the vaccines. In 2021, she made the unsupported claim while on television that people who had received COVID-19 vaccines, quote, do not carry the virus, and, quote, do not get sick, based on, quote, real-world data and data from clinical trials. A few months later, the CDC urged vaccinated people to wear masks because of research indicating no differences in viral load of the amount of virus a person carries after getting infected between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. No difference. She said in April, while testifying to Congress, that the claim was correct when she made it. But she cited no evidence, and her advisors were unable to provide any. Dr. Tracy Hoag, an epidemiologist in California, said this. The studies, quote, all report observed reductions, but none of them found that, quote, vaccinated people do not carry the virus or do not get sick. He says, are they kidding? Seems delusional to come to that conclusion from those articles. Walensky has acknowledged some missteps and ordered a reorganization of the CDC after review found it did not adequately respond to the pandemic. So the restructuring would be aimed at implementing an action-oriented culture that features improved accountability and communication. I thought she did a great job. Why do they need that? Said the review will ensure we have an even more effective CDC. Nowhere to go but up. Literally, nowhere to go but up. They supported lockdowns. She continues to support lockdowns and mandates, even as new evidence has undercut that. She says extraordinary measures are necessary. Really? Extraordinary measures are necessary? God. Of course, they issue largely non-binding recommendations. Some were struck down by courts. Meanwhile, Friday, preventing mandates end as the public health emergency expires. Several will remain, including one by the Department of Veterans Affairs. Yeah. Unbelievable. I mean, look, it's great that we're getting rid of her, but I'm wondering if it's out of the frying pan and into the damn fire with the next one. I mean, I guess they can't really say, oh, I sucked at it. I sucked so bad, they need a new one. But, I mean, at a certain point, when are they just going to come right out and say, you know what? We were wrong. I mean, they're never going to admit it. They just aren't. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. From Fox News, yes, I still read the website. I don't watch the shows, but I read the website. There's this piece about a French transgender athlete who is pissed off that World Athletics has banned him, from competing against women at the 2024 Paris Olympic Games. And this is just, well, I'm going to cover a little bit more on a related story later. World Athletics has banned transgender women from participating in women's sports at the summer 2024 Paris Olympic Games to, quote, to protect the female category. That means all the work French native Halma Diouf has done is all for naught. Diouf, born a male, had been looking forward to running for her home country in France, training for the 200-meter race. Sprinter began treatment to transition as an adult, and French authorities recognized her change in 2021. Recognized her change. However, it means nothing for next summer's games. Diouf sounded off on the World Athletics decision, according to Reuters, citing previous rules and regulations that said trans women and athletes with differences in sex development, DSD, could run in events between 400 meters and the mile if their levels of natural plasma testosterone is below 5 nanomoles per liter. 100 and 200-meter sprinters were clear race. I cannot understand this decision, as transgender women have always been allowed to compete if their testosterone levels were below a certain threshold. The only safeguard transgender women have is their right to live as they wish, and we are being refused that. We are being hounded. I feel marginalized because they are excluding me from competitions. Note that Martina Navratilova said it was a step in the right direction. Despite Diouf's plea, World Athletics has no regrets about its decision, saying it was made to keep competition fair. Decisions are always difficult when they involve conflicting needs and rights between different groups, but we continue to take the view that we must maintain fairness for female athletes above all other considerations, President Sebastian Coe. In March, they cut the maximum plasma levels for long-distance runs in half, and the level must be maintained for 2 years before athletes can participate. You got to see this picture. You got to see it, because I'm pretty sure there's been no significant change in this person. Meaning, I don't think this person is female at all. Just says this person. This person just says they are female. Pretty unbelievable. Of course, it's all about her or him or whatever. Here's a beautiful, more on this. Here's a beautiful op-ed piece from Jason Whitlock. He writes for Outkick as well as The Blaze. This was published on The Blaze's website. Really sums up what the last 60 or so years has brought us. This is really, really beautiful, and I just go to the Blaze website and look for Jason Whitlock's coverage, because, or his op-ed. I would put the thing but it's just so long, the website. It's just, here's what he says. 22 days before his assassination, John F. Kennedy signed the most important piece of legislation of his presidency, the Community Mental Health Act. The act provided federal funding for mental health and research facilities across America. It fueled the United States' deinstitutionalization movement, social and medical reform that shut down insane asylums and treated the mentally ill with psychiatric drugs. Signed on Halloween in 1963, arguably stands as the Emancipation Proclamation for the mentally ill. He says, I know this because yesterday a Twitter user sent me down a mental health rabbit hole with a single tweet. U.S. population in 1955, 161 million. U.S. population today, 332 million. So literally more than double. 1955 mental asylum population, 559,000. Today, 35,000. This is the real crisis. The user sent me a reply in response to my tweet showing a disturbed person harassing a New York police officer at a subway station. The disturbed person was participating in a protest over the death of Jordan Neely, the mentally ill homeless man killed last week inside a New York City subway. Before receiving the tweet, I had no idea that America had dramatically pivoted to how it treats the mentally ill. In Western society, we used to commit, house, restrain, and care for our mentally disturbed inside institutions. Following the lead of Europe in the 1950s, we had concluded that our treatment of the deranged was inhumane. Pharmaceutical companies convinced lawmakers that they could concoct drugs to control the insane. We shut down insane asylums. President Kennedy had a soft spot for the mentally ill. His sister Rosemary suffered brain damage at age 23 after a lobotomy surgery. 4 years after Kennedy signed the Community Mental Health Act, then California Governor Ronald Reagan signed the Lanterman-Petras Short Act, which ended the practice of institutionalizing patients against their will in California. Law made California's prison and homeless population explode. The mentally ill committed crimes and were not taken care of by their families. They lived on the streets or in prison. This all perfectly explains Jordan Neely. Abandoned by his father as a child and made motherless at 14 by a murderous stepfather, Neely fell into depression, mental illness, and crime. Arrested more than 40 times, Neely lived on New York streets and harassed and assaulted people on the subways. Mental illness is America's real crisis. Corporate media are discouraged from discussing the failure of drugs to combat the problem. Big Pharma, with its advertising power, owns the mainstream media. Television networks, internet platforms, and most social media apps depend on Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson's ad dollars. There's considerable risk for any broadcaster or network that questions anything produced by Big Pharma. Rather than analyze our mental health crisis, we've chosen to normalize it. That's why Richard Levine gets to play the role of Rachel Levine, the first quote-unquote female Public Health Service Commission Corps four-star admiral. President Joe Biden appointed Levine as Assistant Secretary of Health, and that's why Biden sat down for a celebratory interview with Dylan Mulvaney, the transgender actor and comedian. Crazy is the new normal. Anyone who doesn't adopt the new normal is branded a racist, homophobe, or transphobe. The name-calling and smear campaigns distract us from addressing the ramifications, consequences, and root causes of our new normals. Are the mentally ill better off living on the streets than inside an asylum? Are they better off inside a prison than in an asylum? Is affirming the delusions and mutilating the bodies of the gender dysphoric more humane than treating their mental disorder? Is living a lie healthier than confronting the truth? I can't speak for every individual, but I can confidently say America is not a better place when we're all forced to live a lie. Just as the truth sets us free, lies limit our freedom. The tweet I received yesterday provoked several epiphanies in me. A decade ago, when I read author Michelle Alexander's best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, her research and narrative on the growth in America's prison population had an enormous impact on my worldview. I swallowed her entire narrative. I bought the book for family and friends. Alexander became one of my four journalistic heroes, alongside Chicago columnist Mike Royko, sports writer Ralph Wiley, and newspaper man turned TV producer David Simon. My longtime LLC is titled RWSA, which stands for Royko, Wiley, Simon, and Alexander, by Mount Rushmore. Alexander blamed mass incarceration on America's fruitless drug war. It's a crock. America's love of drugs and partnership with global drug companies spawned the so-called mass incarceration. That love affair and partnership swelled the prison population. Deinstitutionalization moved the mentally ill from insane asylums to prisons. And the destruction of the nuclear family increased mental instability. The 1960s promoted drug use, promiscuity, the matriarchy, and the destruction of the nuclear family. We bought the lies that a pill could fix every problem, that free love is better than monogamy and marriage, and that feminist rule is superior to the patriarchy. We chose crazy. Our destroyed and tattered families produce crazy like a factory assembly line. Mass incarceration is a consequence of crazy, not racist drug policies. Don't know the solution to our mental health crisis. I do know that normalizing crazy is only making things worse. Two men pretending to be married and raising children increases the insanity. So do child-friendly drag shows and story hours. Normalizing obesity kills. Ascribing a racial motive to every mixed race negative engagement promotes segregation and division. Adopting silly, obvious double standards, such as feigning deep, life-altering emotional pain over a racial slur you use or hear daily, provokes additional foolishness. Ignoring the crazy, belligerent, threatening, and occasionally violent homeless man on the street or subway doesn't improve society or promote safety. Indifference is as lethal as hate. We've grown indifferent to the insanity we've normalized. We've adopted a rep. I'm going to take the time to type this into the chat room because this really is a fantastic view, a fantastic op-ed, a fantastic commentary on the whole situation, the whole problem. I'll tell you what. You know, I talked about those memes that we've seen recently where Trump is looking at a picture of John F. Kennedy and saying, "I'll finish what you started." And I'll say it again. Stop. Stop. Kennedy was selling out communists. He was trying to not just normalize relations with the Soviet Union, he was trying to punish and dismantle some American institutions. So stop with that. Talking about it, you know, people are talking about Robert F. Kennedy right now and saying, oh, he'd be awesome as a running mate. He's still a Kennedy, people. He's still a Kennedy. This is an evil family, born of evil background. He is still a Kennedy. He is still evil. Oh, sure, he's spoken out against vaccine stuff. He's also tried to blame COVID on Trump, despite what Trump tried to do to reopen things and rein in the Faucis and Birxes, people who betrayed him ultimately. But Jason Whitlock absolutely nails it. I'm not saying we need to start throwing people into prisons or asylums, but the idea that people are safely walking the streets amongst crazy people, amongst people who are given who knows what drugs and taking what illicit drugs, God only knows. No, our streets aren't safer because of that. We're not freer. As he nails it perfectly. Truth sets us free. Lies limit our freedom. I've always liked Jason Whitlock. I think he's brilliant. I think he's just a straight shooter. And to affirm what he's talking about, I'm going to give you this story from Yahoo. This just tells you the insanity. Montana's first transgender legislator, Representative Zoe Zephyr, who made national headlines recently after being censored by the State House, got engaged to her girlfriend, trans activist and writer Aaron Reed, at a queer prom event in Missoula, Montana on Friday. Now more than ever, it is vital to uplift and cherish queer joy, the couple said Monday in a joint statement to NBC. We are so incredibly fortunate to have found each other and to work side by side, caring for one another and advocating for our community together for the rest of their lives, they said. We can't put into words just how much it fills our hearts to see the news of our engagement bringing so much happiness to the community when it is needed most, the couple said. We love each other so much, and to see our love resonate with somebody reminds us that queer love will live forever. Queer love? Queer love will live forever. Zephyr gave a speech at Missoula's Queer Prom Friday and described the importance of different types of love, including communal love and interpersonal love. As she addressed the crowd, Zephyr invited Reed to stand next to her. I could not do the things I do in that legislature without her to come home to every night, Zephyr, a Democrat, said of Reed. I think about love, and I think about trans love having been throughout history, to the past, to the future, and to the present moment, and I am so blessed to have Aaron by my side. At one point, Zephyr asked Missoula's queer prom attendees if they would share a moment with her. And then she turned and proposed to Reed. The room erupted into cheers, and Reed said yes. Reed wrote in her newsletter Monday that she was happy to share the joyful story with her readers after what she and Zephyr had experienced recently. Last month, the Montana House voted to censor Zephyr, barring her from the House floor and only allowing her to vote on legislation remotely, after she was accused of inciting protesters in the chamber 2 days earlier. Started when Zephyr told colleagues on the House floor on April 18th that they would have blood on their hands if they supported a bill that would ban gender-affirming care for minors. House Republicans asked her to apologize for the comment on behalf of decorum, but she refused, and they voted not to allow her to speak for 3 days. Protesters descended on the Capitol on April 24th and chanted, "Let her speak," from the House gallery. Zephyr defiantly raised her microphone in the air. 2 days later, House Republicans voted to censor her for the remainder of the legislative session, which ended last week. The bill to ban gender-affirming care for minors ultimately passed. And Governor Greg Gianforte, a Republican, signed it into law, making Montana one of 18 states with laws that restrict such care. Since her censor, Zoe Zephyr has shared on social media that she and Reed have been the targets of swatting, which is a harassment technique where someone falsely reports an emergency situation to law enforcement in an effort to send police to someone's home. Reed wrote in her newsletter, which focuses on trans rights, that the couple met about a year ago due to their work in LGBTQ rights activism. Reed is one of three researchers who have helped create a comprehensive list of the more than 500 state bills targeting LGBTQ rights so far this year. Reed, who is based in Washington, D.C., said it wasn't long before she and Zephyr began making cross-country trips to visit each other. She said they talked about getting engaged, but they discussed waiting until the summer. Clearly, Zoe had other plans, Reed wrote. In a world where trans people often face adversity and their lives are scrutinized, Zoe and I had the opportunity on Friday night to present an alternative vision. In this world, joy takes center stage, allowing us to create a world we are proud to inhabit where love wins. I am honored to embark on this journey by her side. Here's a question. Does Aaron Reed know who? She just got to get. I don't even know if Aaron Reed is trans or a biological woman. That's how effed up this whole thing is. I don't even know what Aaron Reed is. And some would say, well, Hank, what does it matter? It matters because she's been proposed to by a man who says he's a woman. You know, we're now not even saying whether someone who is, quote, trans, whether they have transitioned via surgery or hormones or whatever. It's literally people we just don't know. And people say, well, what does it matter? You think it doesn't? It matters a hell of a lot. I mean, I'm reading a story and I can't even tell you who one of the key figures in the story, who or what she or he is. Yes, it's crazy. Yes, we're being, I mean, look at what it said. It's all about happiness and joy at the center. No, it's not. You're making it about your happiness, maybe. But what is it? Queer love is real love or whatever? Queer love endures? The fact they call it queer love, what does that tell you? A queer prom? Could you imagine? I can't, you know, even if I had been, I mean, even back in high school, if they'd called it white prom, even back when I was in high school, they would have been, what the hell? White prom? Queer prom? Black prom? Whatever. That's effed up, folks. That is way messed up. I'm going to close with this before we go to break and I bring Hawkeye Mike on. This is from Iowa City and Ames, Iowa. 26 current or former athletes in Iowa. 26 former or current athletes and one athletic department employee are being investigated for gambling issues, apparently. Also, possible wagering activity of 15 Iowa State athletes is being looked into. Four Hawkeye baseball players were pulled from games last weekend. And while nothing else really has come out officially as to the nature of the gambling issues, most of the speculation has been about betting on sports other than the ones in which they compete. No word on the number of athletes by sport, although I have heard 10 of the 26 are wrestlers. One name that I heard football-wise was not at all confirmed, so I will not repeat it. Now, admittedly, this isn't good. But by the same token, when DraftKings and FanDuel and other local or statewide gambling operations, including casinos, are not only advertising at college and pro sports venues, but it's possible that some of these are paying NIL money to schools, to players, you know, NIL name, image, likeness. Been mentioned that some of them are giving money to NIL collectives. It's hardly shocking that this would be happening. No, it's not good if athletes can be compromised. Then again, when you watch the officiating of some of these games, you see a play called down from the replay booth, only to go completely and bizarrely against what the average 94-year-old with cataracts can easily see. How in the hell are we supposed to expect that athletes won't occasionally throw down 100 here or a couple hundred there? Now, this comes on the heels of gambling authorities in Ohio. They shut down wagering on University of Alabama baseball, followed by the firing of Alabama's coach. Apparently, in that case, the head coach was alerting others about roster moves and strategy moves before games, and then either placing bets or placing them through proxy. Now, in this case, the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission says no Iowa or Iowa State games have been affected. They aren't even on the radar. It has nothing to do with that. They're not looking in that direction. Other folks are saying that one player may have been texting a girlfriend at halftime to place bets. I seriously doubt that one on the one hand, but when you look at the second half of some of this player's games, then it makes you wonder. Anyway, that's as far as I go news and sports-wise today. I'm going to take a break with a homage to my current automobile situation. And then I'm coming back with Hawkeye Mike. We will finish our three-part tribute to the guitar work of George Harrison and John Lennon in our Great Guitarists Who Are No Longer Here series. We're now going on to their individual work. Individual work. So, meantime, let's get this little break underway so I can get some food, or not some food, some water, and we'll get right back. We'll be back in about 2.5 minutes, and Hawkeye Mike will be joining me.
That's the girl, what she wanted to be. She said, baby, can't you see? I want to be favored, a star of the screen. But you can do something.
are back. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports. I'm going to bring in Hawkeye Mike right now. By the way, I played that song because my car's kind of having some issues, and I'm having issues with the service place as well. So, yeah, I'm going to have to figure out either a new car or a major repair or something. Mike, how you doing?
Doing good, Hank. How's it going?
Oh, other than my car situation, which kind of sucks.
Yeah.
You know, it's going okay. It's going okay. It's just kind of like, what the hell?
Well, I hope
brake
it worked out all right.
Well, brake issues, and then they did this, oh, well, it's not what we thought, you know, that kind of crap. I mean, it's just you know, whatever. So, hey, so first, before we get to the stuff, what do you think all this stuff we heard today from our
our news conference. The press conferences, and it's not really the fault of anybody at the press conference, is that when you get into these things, it's complicated.
Yeah.
But I think the easiest thing, the easiest way to sum it up is to, you know, sort of what's going on for dummies, which I might even throw myself into that category because I'm not a financial or accounting expert, is simply this. What you have going on here is, basically Chinese government entities or affiliates laundering money to the Bidens.
Yeah.
And they are doing this through a lot of sort of dummy corporations and entities that are just kind of shell entities. That to me, it looks like it was solely done for the purpose of trying to give some sort of cover to the Bidens so that it's harder to unravel and they can disguise what's going on. But basically, that's what makes it complicated because you got a scheme here where it's going from one party into a bunch of sort of middlemen, sort of shell types. That
yeah.
then disseminate to entities or even maybe directly from there to certain Bidens. And it's a large number of Bidens that have been getting this money. I'd like to know aside from why they're doing this, which I think they tried to point out at the press conference was being done to obfuscate. But you know, like the question that was asked, and that what I'd really like to know, what was being done by Biden and all these Biden members, family members, what services were they rendering, including,
yeah.
of course, the ultimate question being Joe Biden. I'd like to know what Bo Biden's widow, who then became apparently the lover of Hunter Biden.
What did she do?
What job? What performance was she doing for the funds she received? And there are other Bidens, like I think the children of some of Joe's brothers. I think he's got two brothers, James and Frank, who received
yep.
funds. What did they do? But what did their kids do?
Yeah, how are they involving grandchildren in this?
It's just a slush fund. I think the answer. We know the answer. They didn't do anything.
Yeah.
There might have been. You know, it was all an influence peddling scheme with Joe Biden, or at least. I mean, if Hunter Biden's last name was Brown, and all these other Biden's last names were Brown, would they be getting anything? No. It's all because
yeah.
the relatives of Joe Biden, and in Hunter's case in particular, was trafficking in his dad's name, in his family name, to curry favor and get largesse from these basically Communist Party front organizations. I mean, it's pretty
yeah.
Now, I think Comer says that there's other countries, you know, since we've already heard some allusions to stuff going on in, I think, Ukraine. I'd like to know, I think Romania came up. I'd like to know
yeah.
what other countries, you know, was going on here. But it's basically a pay-to-play type thing, I guess. You know, they're trying to come back and say, well, What did they do that was illegal? Well, we don't really know yet, but I don't think that they were expecting something, and I think something must have been given.
Yeah.
Or why were you paying? I mean, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars now. That's
yeah.
another thing. It's a lot more money than thought at first. But, you know, we're just going to have to see. It's complicated. So, and then there's a whole bunch of bias in the press. They don't want any of this to come out. So,
of course
I
not.
Mean, they're going to have but I think what might happen is as more and more of this comes out, the next step's going to be impeachment proceedings based on public corruption and even betraying the country. And when that happens, that will get the attention of the country, and then they can put this stuff out, and the Democrats can try to explain it away as no big deal.
Yeah. Hey, they could try explaining it away. I mean, first of all, who uses their supposedly a grandchild being used to this? Who the hell does that? Who exposes their grandchildren to something like that? You know, I mean, how sick is that? But here's another question.
Well,
how come nothing's coming up with regard like to the Obamas? This was during his presidency. You're going to, I mean, put it this way. If it had been Mike Pence, they would have gotten all over Trump with it. You know, they wouldn't have just ignored it. You know, they would have tied Trump to it.
Yeah.
So why is Obama immune
to this?
At
this point, they're trying to nail down what Biden and his family are doing. And the tentacles of this may go beyond even the Bidens. I wouldn't be surprised at all. We'll have to see if Obama gets implicated or not. But, you know, that's we're at sort of at step two. That might be step 8 or 9.
Yeah.
So let's, you know, you have to kind of stay tuned on that. But, you know, it's always tough. It's not sexy in the sense that a lot of people, you know, you listen to that press conference for 10 or 15 minutes and your eyes can start, you know, and your brain can start glazing over a little bit because it's not easy. If you're not an accountant or financial expert, it's hard to understand. I think just the easiest thing is that the Chinese government for the most part was funneling money to the Bidens through third party entities.
Yeah, they were basically selling influence. That's basically bottom line is the Bidens were selling influence.
Like they kept saying, you know, it's not a legitimate way to do business, right? It's sort of like if you remember, you're playing that clip with Sam Kinison from Back to School. Remember in the next class he goes to, he's in the business class.
Yeah.
And he starts talking about the, you know, you're leaving out a whole bunch of stuff. You know, you forgot about all the – local politicians.
Yeah, he's talking about concrete.
Goes,
yeah, concrete.
And then there's
I'm not
those
sure
waste.
You know who...
Remember, he goes, and then there's those waste disposal problems. Goes, I'm not sure if you're familiar with who's in that business, but I can assure you it's not the Boy Scouts.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
he goes,
exactly.
You know, I mean, you know, it's complicated, right? So, you know.
Yeah.
Graph
but,
usually
I mean,
is.
How they make it acceptable is what I guess, you know, there are already people that are trying to say, it's like, well, it's not that big a deal. You know, there are already people doing that. It's like, really? How is it not that big a deal? You know, that's what the part I don't get. But they're trying to, again, it's normalizing certain things and making it, you know, it's A-okay. I mean, the whole thing. So, okay, so we're continuing our great guitarists who are no longer here. We did Jeff Beck. We did Tommy Boland, Terry Kath, and then, now we're doing Harrison and Lennon. Beatles to the studio era to now their solo work. I think I mentioned this before. Harrison was actually the first one to release solo work of any of them. And oddly enough, John Lennon, who many would say is the most musically creative, was the last to release any solo work. For a while, anyway, Harrison was the most prolific, especially when you consider some of, you know, Concerts for Bangladesh, Dark Horse. Although I saw some people called it the Dark Horse, H-O-A-R-S-E, because he was a apparently had laryngitis through all that. And then now, of course, McCartney has become, you know, for a while, McCartney was putting something out every damn month. But, you know, pretty amazing. So here's what I wanted to say, okay? I maintain that, in my opinion, Harrison's solo work of all of them, I think, is the most musically relevant and most musically brilliant. He literally, I think he could have walked away after 33 and a third without ever having picked up a guitar, walked into a studio or onto a stage, and he'd still be left with the phrase utter brilliance as his legacy. Your opinion on that?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, in some ways for both him him and Lennon, some of their most interesting stuff is post-Beatles, and you kind of touching on with Harrison, which I do agree with. You know, neither one of us, I think, included any tunes, but there's one aspect to Harrison that we didn't really get into, which you could, were the two Traveling Wilburys albums. But
that wasn't solo work, obviously. So that's kinda...
no. But it was stuff that he had played a pretty large creative role in.
It was a collaboration
with several other artists. But you know, I mean, I just bring it up to point out that Harrison has had a rather, and that was later on. That was after most of his. I don't remember when the last album was, and I can't remember the name, but it's the one that had. I've Got My Mind Set on You, and I can't remember what the name of the album is. So that was like in the late 80s, I think.
Yeah, he actually had a run.
I think the Traveling Wilburys came out just after that.
Yeah, they did. They were actually they actually finished his last solo album after he died, his son and Jeff Lynn from ELO and the Traveling Wilburys. Here's another thing that a lot of people don't know. In 1974, there was a bootleg album made, a bootleg session with Lennon, McCartney. They were literally both there. People, you know, Stevie Wonder, Jesse Ed Davis, Bobby Keys from the Stones. I believe Harry Nilsson was there. That they appeared on, that they actually worked together. I also didn't know this about Lennon. He actually worked. He's actually a co-writer of the song "Fame" by David Bowie. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, he co-wrote.
There was a lot of stuff they did, sort of, not just Lennon, but McCartney as well for other groups.
Yeah,
that vocal part in Fame,
you know, the fame, where it went from falsetto to bass, that was Lennon. I did not know that. That was Lennon. He was also playing rhythm guitar on that song. You know, so he obviously was working, but he just wasn't as prolific, obviously, as Harrison. Here's my other thing. I think if he had not been assassinated shortly after its release, I contend that Double Fantasy, although it has some good songs on it, I think it would have been viewed as, by his standards, as average. I don't think it would have been as well received. I don't think it would have sold as much if he had not been assassinated. What do you think on that? I think that's
probably true, but I don't have a problem with his contribution overall. The problem with the album is that half of it is just, you know, his no talent. Let's be honest. I don't have any animus toward Yoko Ono, but she is not a musician or a composer. And her weird screaming and just, you know,
crawling around in a giant paper bag.
Let's put it this way, to be kind, unmelodious contributions on Double Fantasy, just kind of think the album in my mind. I mean, I did get the album, right. I'm sure it was fueled, but there was some good music by Lennon on that. I would also cut him a little slack in that he, you know, he'd kind of been out of it for several years. He was just kind of getting things back up, you know.
I say, with some of her stuff, I mean, dealing with Yoko, I mean, that's a handicap. He also, though, I mean, that bootleg album that they're talking about, Stevie Wonder, who's a pretty fairly brilliant musician himself, he was wanting to lead them into these, like, nursery rhymes. And in the background, evidently, Lennon could be heard saying, you know, this equipment's a problem, this other stuff, you know, we have other problems here, and we're doing, you know, what are we singing here? Now, he doesn't say this, but I, you know, basically they were singing nursery rhymes. And here's a guy that's supposed to be so drunk and so coked up, but he still has the presence of mind to know basically they're doing sock hop music and she'd be doing symphonies, you know? I mean, you can say he was weird in his sit-ins and all that, but at the same time, to have that presence of mind, you know, you simply just – you just can't, you know, discount. I mean, what it basically amounts to a drunk gathering, and he still has the presence of mind to say, guys, what are we doing? We should be doing something really, really great. So, you know, by the way, you said he'd been out of it. You know what song pushed him back into the studio? What song pushed Lennon back into the studio?
What song of his or what song of someone else?
Another person did a song. It was by McCartney, and it it sort of like gave him the impetus to get back into the studio and get back to the creative mindset. Do you happen to know what that was?
It's not coming to mind, so you can enlighten me.
Coming up. McCartney's Coming Up. And here's the...
Oh, really?
You know, that song, the record company wanted the live version on the album. Paul did not. And John agreed. And supposedly he said, when he heard it, he said, "Fuck a pig, it's Paul." And then he said, "It's driving me crackers." He couldn't get the song out of his head. He loved the song. He says he understands record executives wanted the live version because, quote, "you're hearing real Paul versus the studio version." But he said, "Look, man, that's the one. That's the freaky creative version, the one he did in his barn." So here was a song in 1980 that I kind of thought, it's not Paul's best. I do like the song, actually. But, you know, that's what pushed him to get back. So, you know, everybody always says, oh, they hated each other. And at the end, they didn't. You know, that's not true. I mean,
well, there was a live version on the album that came out with that, wasn't there? Because it seems like I remember, you know, it's like live from
Glasgow, that's
okay.
The original album version that they put on the studio album was that studio version of it, which I like that, but I like both of them. So, but, yeah, you know,
what inspired Lennon, though, huh? Okay.
Inspired Lennon to get – because he said, you know, he did the speeded up vocals on it, and he said, you know, he just said it was – he loved the drive of it, that it was, you know, sort of a he said he's pushing through. You know, he's not just doing the quote-unquote silly love songs and all that. He's still got it. He basically said Paul still got it. You know, he definitely still got it. I mean, they said that about each other, you know.
There's an interesting story. You might have heard this. The last couple of years before Lennon's murder, they did pretty much, you know, because there had been in the early 70s, we can get into this on a couple of songs that I have, but they were pretty estranged, but they did kind of get things patched up again.
Yeah.
And I think you even had Lennon saying, look, you know, everybody's always asking, will the Beatles get back together? And he goes, and this is a little bit unfair, and I don't agree with it. He said, well, you know, it could happen. He goes, but let's be blunt. He goes, it's Paul and I that matter.
Yeah.
Which I think was a kind of a diss to, well, obviously to Ringo, but a diss to Harrison. And but you know, Lennon could be a little bit that way.
Yeah, and George, you know, George, I guess he didn't like that in one of his books, George basically, you know, didn't talk much about Lennon at all.
He's getting short shrift. Well, he's getting short shrift, he felt, and I think probably with some reason, on his, you know, especially in the latter years of the Beatles, I would say even from Revolver onward, he had a lot of music that they just Paul and John just didn't seem to have time for, you know.
Yeah.
They might give him a song or two on the on an album, and that was about it, you know. But by the time Abbey Road, you know, came around, his contributions, his writing was right up there. And,
oh, yeah, no doubt.
You know, so I think that was part of the thing that fed, you know, you remember, I don't know if you saw the Get Back documentary where he walked out during the middle of the sessions and they got him back, but I mean, he could tell he was getting a little tired of his treatment from the other two. And, you know, so that would have been an interesting dynamic as to how that would have played out had Lennon lived, because I do think there would have been, you know, you can tell speculation that there would have been some sort of get back of the Beatles in the early mid 80s. If Lennon had not been killed. And I think that one of the things that really comes up where you might have seen a real live performance, it would have been the perfect venue, would have been at Live Aid in 1985.
Yeah, exactly.
You probably would have had a live appearance by the Beatles at that.
Yeah, if you remember, I watched most of Live Aid that day, all day.
I did, too.
If you remember, they spent a good amount of time talking about, you know, remember they did the Phil Collins tracker because he played at Wembley and then took a helicopter to Heathrow and then flew over to Philly to play on the U.S. side. But you remember, they were talking about, you know, there's speculation that Julian Lennon could appear with the other surviving Beatles. You know, they talked about that. So, you know, that's how many, that's 15 years after the Beatles had broken up, you know, that they were still,
right.
You know, and John in one of his last interviews said, you know, look, the Beatles might be gone, but George, John, Paul, and Ringo, or however he forgot the order, he says, they all go on. That's just, you know, there's just no denying that, you know, the differences.
I think they would have got together, though, even before Live Aid, at least in the studio. And they may have played, they might have played live. Certainly you had with Harrison and McCartney, they had no aversion after the Beatles broke up to doing all kinds of live performances. Lennon did some stuff too before he kind of went, you know, retired for several years.
Right.
So I could see it. You know, I mean, there was always an ability for them to capture the attention of the world like no other group. So I think it's at some point, you know, it's all speculation, right? Because you know, but I think most people that kind of know things know that there probably would have been something done. That's what was so, you know, I'm sure you remember what you were doing when you heard about Lennon. I was watching Monday Night Football, actually.
I was reading for a psychology test, but somebody came up and told me what had happened. So,
yeah, you know, you think that's it. You know, it's never going to happen now. And it, you know, obviously, that was the case. You can talk about bringing in Julian or bringing in somebody else. It's not the Beatles, you know.
Right. Exactly. So let's get to the songs.
Anyway.
First of all, I omitted and I'll talk about it later. I omitted My Sweet Lord. I'm going to talk about it in a later song. So you chose the first one that I'm going to play, If Not For You. That's from the All Things Must Pass album. Interestingly, it's been redone by others, including Olivia Newton-John. And the guitar work, the slide work on this is awesome. So let's get right to it. If Not For You from Harrison's All Things Must Pass.
Thank you. not for you. The winter would hold no spring. Couldn't hear a robin sing. I just wouldn't have a clue. It's not for you. Not for you.
So that song was actually written by Bob Dylan, and he did it on his, I guess it was a 1970 session, New Morning. But he also performed it with Harrison, and Harrison, of course, did a great version for his first. And when I say his first, it wasn't his first album. He actually had done two other albums. One was sort of a movie soundtrack. I think that was Wonderwall, and I forgot the name of the other one. But they were, you know, they were in a sense experimental albums more than anything. This first one from John Lennon, Crippled Inside. Tell me a little bit about this one.
Well, I mean, it's not a whole lot to tell. This was, I believe, on the Imagine album, which is maybe a lot of people would say is his best album. I like the title song is very good, but I think that some of the other songs on there, including this one, are even better. We've got another one, if we get to it, How Do You Sleep?
Yeah.
But this was during a period where there was particular estrangement between him and McCartney, and a lot of the songs are pretty costly, as only Lennon can do, directed at McCartney. And so Crippled Inside's referring to McCartney.
Okay.
Just like How Do You Sleep it does too.
Right. So let's roll this one, Crippled Inside, from the Imagine album. interesting thing about that song, that almost sounds like going back to almost the roots of the stuff they were doing early. Not so much the rocker part, but when they sort of got into the folkish aspects, which they sometimes did, especially when they returned from Germany to England. Now, we'll swerve a little bit. We're going to go to George's first album again, George's first real album, All Things Must Pass. This is the first song on the album. And it's a short song. It's 3 minutes, but I think it perfectly says where he was emotionally and mentally at this point, that he is, you know, he's still musically got stuff inside his head, but he's also kind of probably going through other stuff, like with his wife at the time, Patty, who ends up marrying Eric Clapton later on. But so this is called I'd Have You Anytime. Just an absolutely beautiful opening song for that album. I mean, I think it the slide work on it is just unbelievable, and he ties it all up in 3 minutes. Absolutely beautiful. So you mentioned How Do You Sleep, and I did upload it, but I want to make sure that we have enough time. So believe it or not, I'm going to have to get away from All Things Must Pass. But I'm going to go to the next Lennon one that I picked. It's really the only one that I picked. I absolutely love this song. And, you know, when I heard it in sixth or seventh grade, I thought, yeah, it's a good song. But I sort of forgot about it. And then I heard it, 25 years later or so. And just, not that long, 20 years later. And just said, God, that's an awesome song. And so I made sure to go out and buy Walls and Bridges. It's called Number Nine Dream. And although people think it's Yoko who's voicing it in the background, it is not. It is during John's time with May Pang, his quote-unquote lost weekend, as he later called it, even though it lasted about 2 or 3 years, where he and Yoko were basically estranged, and he was with May Pang for a while. And that's her voicing it, the vocals on the background of this song. So this is Number Nine Dream. And I think both both his electric and acoustic work here is absolutely fabulous. Here goes. That was number nine, Dream. So, hey, Mike, I'm going to swerve back to
good
something
choice.
For a
That's
second.
I like that one.
I know. Yeah. It is a great song. I was, you know, we were talking about the gambling stuff in Iowa City, and T. Boney sent a message, and it's now up to 120 athletes. Have you heard more on that?
No, it's at just starting to break. I can't believe how it could be that massive. I'm just
– I don't either.
It's obviously
I don't get
not
it.
– if they're, it may touch the football program, but it's got to be a lot more than that. I think
yeah.
they implicated a lot of wrestlers or something like that.
Yeah, they've 10 of them.
I would caution, though, to be a little bit – this is the kind of thing that can end up really hurting Iowa athletics because the NCAA could really come down hard if these things get established. And if it's on this kind of scale, I mean, what is going on here?
Yeah. Well, they say most of the speculation is that it's underage gambling. So, you know, that's kind of the thing.
Is it unrelated to like betting, you know?
Yeah, supposedly none of it was betting on any of their own games.
Just betting
supposedly,
Las Vegas stuff or something.
Supposedly not. Not Vegas, betting on their own sports, and they said none of the games were compromised that they can see. Some other people are speculating it's basically underage gambling, that people have just basically been, you know, doing like who knows what, but it's more of an underage gambling thing, supposedly. So, you know, who knows? I mean, you just don't know.
Well, if it's
and
established, I think that at a minimum, you're going to see a lot of people kicked off various teams if
yeah.
they establish the state.
No doubt.
See what happens.
I would not, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that's going to happen, you know, that they're going to miss time or whatever. So who knows? And the other thing I want to ask you about, I haven't really talked much about some of the Trump news, the recent, you know, like lawsuits, you know, stuff like that. Where do you think his campaign is right now? In terms of some of these, you know, this was a civil suit that came recently, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. You're talking about with this E. Jean Carroll. Well, I think it's a real flake, by the way. But, obviously it's not helpful. It's not the same as a criminal conviction. The burden of proof standard of evidence is a lot lower. But there are some problems with this, not least of which is, again, you know, this is a situation where you have in this case, it's a federal judge, but a Democratic appointee, Clinton appointee, in one of the most heavily Democratic anti-Trump cities. So you have to consider the jury pool. And, you know, whether it's true or not, Trump can certainly say with some, you know, a lot of, especially his own supporters will say, that this, you know, the deck was stacked here, and there was some interesting things in this case that, as from a legal aspect, make me shake my head. Some of the stuff that was allowed to come in, I think is problematic and grounds for appeal. They allowed the tapes to come in from, you know, the recordings he made that came out. Was it on that Access Hollywood?
Yeah, whatever, with Billy Bush or whatever.
It had nothing to do with this woman. So, I mean, to bring that in as character evidence, normally the rules of evidence do not permit character evidence to come in to show he did bad things before, therefore it's likely that what he's being accused of now he did. That's highly prejudicial, and it does not go to this woman. And by the way, the stuff on Access Hollywood was locker room talk. I mean, it's not really that he did.
Yeah.
I think they allowed testimony from two other women who did not bring a lawsuit to this day to come in and say that he, basically acted, you know, made passes, crude passes at him. It's what it amounts to, all in for the purpose of trying to show that this E. Jean Carroll, whatever her name is.
Yeah.
Did you know, was a victim. And I think it's problematic it's kind of puzzling to me that kind of evidence was allowed to come in when the question is are her allegations of what happened to her true? And for that, there's only two people that know, and that's Donald Trump and her.
Yeah.
So I do think that there's some problems with the way the court handled this. They seem to be very pro-plaintiff, you know, for E. Jean Carroll and a lot of the rulings and anti-Trump. And actually, Trump didn't do himself any favors when he went into a deposition and basically reiterated some of the stuff he said in the Access Hollywood tapes about, you know, you can get away with anything when you're a celebrity. And,
right.
Yeah, I'm a celebrity, you know. You can, you know, the grab them by the pussy kind of stuff. For him to double down on that in a deposition, that's just not very bright.
No. So here's something else that happened in Iowa. Go back to the state of Iowa. You know, what's his name? Vivek. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but Vivek, it looks like Ramaswamy or something, but I'm not sure that's how it's actually pronounced.
Ramaswamy,
so
that's right. Yeah.
He's in Cedar Rapids, and he's announcing a proposal to amend the Constitution to raise the voting age from 18 to 25 unless a person has served in the military or as a first responder or can pass the civics test that immigrants take when becoming citizens. Now, a lot of people are freaking out about it. You know, I shouldn't say a lot of people, but people are.
Raise the voting age?
Voting age from 18 to 25.
Well,
why would
you know, that's an interesting proposal. I would just say this is never going to happen.
Right.
You know, so, but I mean, I've always felt all along, I mean, I'm kind of in the back of my mind, I don't know, again, it would never happen, I think, couldn't get it done. Was that, you know, do you want people that are completely ignorant of even the most basics of civics to be voting? I mean, if you don't know when the Civil War happened or who fought in it, you know, you see these man on the street stuff that Jesse Waters used to do. And they think that the Civil War was a fight between the United States and Japan or something. You know, just, I mean, it's like, what is going on? And yet these people are voting for President of the United States. But you know, the most important thing, though, we need to know about Vivek Ramaswamy is that one of his key campaign strategists is none other than the University of Iowa's own Jagdish Khandelwal, who I think you remember from
I would hope not. I hope it's not him.
Well, I won't use his nickname, but I think you know who he is. And apparently he still wears those fire engine reds.
Oh, God. Unbelievable. So, okay, I was just looking at other stuff from Dopey Joe, you know, with this stuff from today. And the reason is it says the FBI won't share a document that the Republicans subpoenaed. Is that
okay,
really?
Well, that's news. I knew they subpoenaed it. And I kind of expected they might not, but has that been officially the position?
It just says the FBI did not comply with the House Oversight Committee compelling the production.
Did they even respond, or did they just not crickets right now?
It doesn't. I'm looking at it. It says they said the whistleblower alleged the document. Oh, it's a whistleblower who alleged that the document includes a precise description of how it was done as well as its purpose. And he gave them until Comer gave them until noon, and they did not produce it. Do you think they ever will?
Well, that's a good. It depends. I mean, this is a congressional subpoena, so there's a problem, especially if they've not even responded, let alone given any kind of a justification for not responding. My understanding is that this is not a classified document. If they try to classify it now, it looks really suspicious, but it's not. So I would like to know if they're not complying with this, why they're not. Now, my understanding is that the FBI director was going to be up in front of a congressional hearing today, and he'd probably be asked about that. So I would like to hear why, if there is a reason why they are not compliant with subpoena. But the subpoenas, you know, are a legal process, and if they are flaunted, then Congress can take action. Now, the problem there is normally you would go to the Justice Department to do it, which is Democrat-controlled, and that can be a problem. If you remember during that crossfire hurricane thing with Obama's Attorney General, Eric, what's his name?
Eric Holder.
Where he was held in contempt for not complying with subpoenas. And nothing came of it because they didn't prosecute him. Whereas when Republicans refused to comply with the January 6th subpoenas, the Justice Department was all too happy to prosecute certain people like Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro guy.
Right.
And so there is an avenue if the Justice Department won't cooperate in terms of trying to help them enforce the subpoena. They can hire their own counsel to do it, I believe, if they want to, or go through the Sergeant of Arms office, the House of Representatives. We'll see. I think that Comer has said there is a plan B if they won't comply with the subpoena. And I would just say that it looks bad if they just fail to comply and they don't have a reason. But a lame reason would be a bad one, too. Obviously, this would not be good for Joe, and it would make the FBI look really bad and the Department of Justice if this is true, and I have every reason to believe it is, that there is this, I think it's called a 1023 form or something like that.
Yeah, it is.
Where it's outlines, that a bribery scandal that involves Joe Biden himself. Yeah, we'll see what happens. But if they haven't complied, I'm sure we'll hear from Comer pretty quick. And by the way, old Chuck Grassley was involved in this too. I think it was his whistleblower that came forward.
Yeah.
And then Comer issued the subpoena because the Senate's controlled by Democrats.
Okay. So now back to the debt ceiling. Biden says he's considering using the 14th Amendment to avoid the debt borrowing limit. And basically, part of it reads like this. It says the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payments of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. Is he high, or is that?
Well, as you can tell from that language, it's pretty vague. And I would point out, whether that means that gives him unilateral authority to hike the debt ceiling or to, which is done basically to ensure that we don't default on debts. It's a viable theory, but it's never been put into practice, and there's never been any sort of legal attempt to do this, to use the 14th Amendment to do that. And I think Biden himself pointed out what the problem with that is that if he was to do that, it would be challenged in the courts and it would take a long time to work its way through. And so it wouldn't be something that could be done immediately. So he's basically back to the situation. They can try to do that. That'll be down the road that maybe, in a year, the courts will rule that he could do it. But in the meantime, we're going into default if he doesn't work something out with the Republicans. So here's the thing that I think the interesting thing is that, the Republicans are putting all these strings and playing with fire. Well, the Republicans passed the bill that raises the debt ceiling. The problem is the Democrats don't like the strings that are attached, and they would apparently rather see us default on our debt than engage in any kind of fiscal responsibility that might include a decline in the increase of spending, which is really all it is. So, who's the ones being unreasonable, right? Democrats trying to play Republicans as being extremists. But if they would rather default than agree to, reasonable cuts in out-of-control spending, who's the ones being unreasonable and radical here?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just don't know. It's just crazy what's happening. I mean, as Joseph Gibson points out in the chat room, the debt can never be paid. We'll never get it paid back. It's never, we're never going to, even if we balance the budget, I forgot what it was for how long we'd have to balance the budget. Even that would pay the debt back, just balancing the – I mean, we literally
need to
run –
It would just keep you from increasing further is all that would happen. Yeah. Well, I think that as you get closer to whenever the real default date is, I said it could be as early June, there'll be pressure on Biden to kind of, and I think he's kind of, there was a headline earlier today about that he's kind of caving a little bit because, look, if we do go into default, he's the president. So he can blame the Republicans all he wants, but if bad things start happening, the bottom line is it's going to, and the Republicans say, hey, we passed a bill that raises it. It's going to be tough on him. And I think he knows it. And so, you know, I think McCarthy's saying, look, we're not demanding that everything we've done be accepted, but come, let's negotiate, you know, let's negotiate and see what we can do. And up till now, he's kind of refused to do that. So I think at some point, if Republicans don't cave, which you never know with Republicans, right? I think that they can get that Biden's going to have to come to an accommodation.
Yeah, I agree. It's just starting to wear out a little bit. We come up to this now. I mean, when's the last time that we actually had an actual budget? We've just been running on continuing resolutions year after year now for a while, haven't we?
Yeah, right. I think so. Yeah, I hope that at least the Republicans will get a budget through and then pass appropriations bills, so that you don't have this threat of shutdowns all the time. But I think Democrats like to stall appropriations bills and then have these big continuing resolutions at the end where you throw the kitchen sink in.
Yeah.
And, you know, so which is no way to really run a government, really.
No, it's not. I mean, it's ridiculous. And here's the thing. They're literally, just kicking the can down the road, as everyone says. But I mean, I thought we were supposed to have an actual budget in place. I thought that was part, but maybe I'm thinking that maybe not at the federal level. Still, it's just Joe Gibson put out, the public includes foreign investors, foreign governments. They account for 30% of the debt. The individual investors and banks, 15%. The Federal Reserve holds 12% of the treasuries issued. It just be, you know, it depends on who. I mean, it ruins. I mean, our credit rating, so to speak, got downgraded, I remember, several years ago. But, you know, it's just kind of meaningless after a while. I just don't get why we're hearing these things like using the 12th, 14th Amendment to do stuff and whatnot. And did you hear this? You know, California's got this reparations thing going. Have you heard their latest, what they want? The reparations committee?
Well, it depends on the reparations committee was going to, they're basically going to give something like 1.2. The recommendation I thought was 1.2 million to every African-American in California. And of course, and a lot of the left wing black groups were up in arms saying it should be closer to 200 million. I mean, it's insane. Even at one point, if you're going to give I don't know what it, 20% of the population of California, which is, would be a couple million people, I think, at least.
Yeah.
You're going to give them each one 1.2 million. I mean, it's insane. That alone would be twice what their current budget is. How are they going to pay for that? There's no way.
Yeah, they're not. Well, no,
it's basically a shakedown of society by a lot of these African American leaders to just get more money. And you know the taxpayers are gonna shell out this money. Is that supposed to be a racial reconciliation? It's gonna cause resentment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a mass exodus from California, which is already going on.
Yeah. Well, no, it gets better. The reparations task force is now calling for the state to issue a formal apology for a former governor coining the term "welfare queen." And for the disproportionately low number of black Californians working as doctors and lawyers. Who do you think the governor was that coined that term that they wanted an apology
for?
Ronald Reagan.
It's also true. It also has the virtue of being true. But the disproportion of doctors and lawyers. Well, I mean, is that systemic racism? Or is that a failure of our education system to bring up, elevate the African American population to be in a position where they can get into law school and medical school.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess when it's I don't want to say humorous, it's not, it's sad, and it's just pitiful, pathetic. He was governor, let's put it this way, he left office January 6th, 1975. So we're literally talking about something 50 years ago.
It would be an apology to many people that weren't even alive when,
exactly,
when he said it. But one thing about, and I think this shows you he has ambitions of running for president, and he knows it wouldn't help him, and that is Gavin Newsom has come out and said he doesn't support this.
Oh, he has said that?
Reparations payments. Yes, he said he doesn't support paying these reparations, which will infuriate the left wing. But if he was to sign a bill that did, that was insane to do that, he would never be able to live it down if he ever had aspirations to run as president, I don't think.
Well, here's the beauty. California never had slavery in its history. Literally never. There was never slavery in California. But, of course, they say the state still worked to uphold the institution and discriminated in other ways. I mean, literally, they're just making stuff up as they go along now. It's just
Grievance crowd, you know. It's basically taking money from people who never owned slaves and giving it to people who were never enslaved, based on the notion that 150 years ago, their ancestors had been slaves. And that there's been systemic racism since then. Now, I don't buy the systemic racism. I think it's all a bunch of bullshit. As I say, the grievance crowd, I don't think this country is, at least not now, and I don't think it has been for a long time, systemically racist. I think the problem in the black community lies primarily with the black community and fundamentally in the breakdown of the black family that has caused a lot of trouble. You've got scores of black men that don't get educated, that don't have prospects because of that. And the opportunities are there for black Americans as well as other Americans to pull themselves up and you know, get the American dream. Yeah. But for a lot of problems innate to the black community, I know that some people might say, I don't think this is racist. I think this is just factual that's what the real problem is and why the black community continues to suffer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, they're not being done favors by people like, you know, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, whoever, you know, I've talked about it before, but you literally have, you know, like when people say, you know, blacks don't get afforded the opportunity. Of course they do. But here's the problem. The problem isn't that the money's not there, that they don't get. The problem is, as an example, and I see this with our local Kiwanis Club, that we work with a lot of at-risk youth and some programs where they pair cops and kids together. And it's actually a great program. And it's not all black kids, but it is predominantly. But you know what it is. I mean, when you hear about one of these kids who gets a scholarship or whatever, he or she is the first person in their family to go to college. They have no blueprint in their family. You know, nobody in their family has ever gone to college. So there's no urging this kid to go to college. I mean, even kids that have excelled don't have a role model that's ever done it. So you know what, when you've never had that, how do you become, you know, how do you get on this fast track, or how do you gain these aspirations to go to college? You don't. I mean, it's, you know, would we have gone to college if our parents before us hadn't gone and our friends and all that weren't going? Maybe not.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a pattern. It's not a systemic racism issue. That's why I get infuriated by it and we still hear it. And in this case, you know, well, it wasn't slavery. It was just, you know, just keeping the man down, so to speak. I mean, they're literally making it up as they go along. And we're running down this terrible road. I mean, on so many other fronts. I know I've been jumping a lot on the trans bandwagon lately, but I think Jason Whitlock said it perfectly. We are normalizing it, and we are saying it's normal for 5-year-olds to sit in a drag queen story hour or a drag queen show. at 5 years old. And Steve Dace said it even better.
Yeah.
Don't ask why they have these shows. Ask why they want five-year-olds at these shows. You know, that's the sick part.
Because you
got to
get
know?
Them at an early age. That's what the thing is here, Hank. You know what I mean? They want to – education is about indoctrination, not education. And part of that includes, you know, all this stuff with the drag queen story hour to allowing 12-year-olds to decide to have gender reassignment surgery or at least go down that path and not telling their parents. I mean, the notion – that a 12-year-old who can't buy a beer by law or sign a contract or serve in the military or own a gun can make that kind of a decision, irreversible gender reassignment surgery, without their parents having a say or knowing about it?
Exactly.
It's insane. It's insane.
Exactly. So, hey, we ran out of time, and so I did not plan enough time to finish our stuff. But we will finish it in a future show with more of the music. I just didn't get time, and I didn't want to – and that's why I wanted to get back to some of this stuff, because some of the stuff I wanted to sort of talk about, but and we'll talk about more. In the meantime, hey, thanks for being on again, and we will talk, of course, by text, et cetera, and we'll talk to you hopefully next week.
Okay.
Folks,
that's
it.
Thanks, Hank. Take care.
Thanks. Thanks, Mike. That's it for this week, folks. We've run out of time, and we just, you know, there's a lot of stuff to get to. I am going to do a Hank Rings a week from tomorrow. I'm not going to do it tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow, so I will cover more of this, and I might cover more of the music portion with Mike. Meantime, I'll be back next week, and we will hit on what's wrong with this country and why we are letting it happen and why we must not let it continue. God bless, folks. Have a good night.